This is Eunice Scarfe, and it's the third session of a series called Mother May I, in which we're looking at examples of fiction which illustrate relationships or which reveal relationships between individuals and not just between mothers and children, but the Mother May I taken as a metaphor of relationships and the play, the tension between individuals who are in relationship to each other. We took a story on Monday called The Little Angel Cometh. And the second one, that was by Gertrude Story. The Tuesday was Ruth Cron's Homestead Crescent, and to date is Mary Riskin's Print Dresses, which was published in Malahat Review out of Victoria, University of Victoria, in the last year. Before I go into the story today and be reading the story, we do save paper around here, and that's part of why the story is read. Before I start the story today, I'd like to show you three books that have come into the library that I mentioned on Monday, and they've arrived since then. The two are two of them are Margaret Lawrence, who I said was a Manitoba writer, about 65 or 70 now. Her two of the most famous are a collection of stories called A Bird in the House. That's the title story of the collection. They are connected by a child called Vanessa, and they're often referred to as the Vanessa stories. They're thinly autobiographical accounts of growing up in a Scotch-Irish, I believe, or English-Irish home. On the prairie, first generation, you get the story of the immigrant, the play between the different kinds of immigrants in the town, and her own recollection of the two families, which were two different cultures combining, and other things of interest to just the growing up. It would be classified under growing up stories. Some really nice ones in there. She did this in 62. They've been anthologized all over Canada. I don't know if you would find them in any of your anthologies. Bird in the House, Horses of the Night is a very nice story of one of her cousins who goes off to war and is unable to cope with any of it. Eventually disintegrates. And the other quite famous one is A Stone Angel. Hagar, and the biblical name is chosen deliberately, is in her later years and is reviewing her life in a series of flashbacks that goes forward and back, forward and back. The Stone Angel is in the cemetery of the town, and Margaret Lawrence's fictional town is Manawanka. And the Stone Angel in the cemetery. Is this set in Manawaka as well? The Vanessa stories certainly are. The Stone Angel is taken as an image that's looked at from many times during the story, the Stone Angel in the cemetery. So these two are for the library. If you want them here, you're welcome to use them. They're not yet cataloged, but you can circulate them until you go. This is bought for the bookstore, Obasan, which means aunt in Japanese. This is the first story to come out of Canada of the incarceration, is that the right word? Removal of the Japanese from the coast, the west coast. This woman, Joy Kogawa, was brought to Coaldale, Alberta, in perhaps the middle, early 40s, as a child, 6 or 7. She's a Canadian poet. Several years ago, she sent a manuscript to another novelist who coincidentally had grown up in the same town. It's quite ironic that from such a small town, two major novelists came and said, "What do I do with this?" And it's a thinly disguised recollection, narration of when she, a third generation Canadian, and her father, an Anglican minister, was removed overnight from their home into the interior of Alberta because of, and you know the historical setting, because of the war. They are still using Japanese words, such as obasan, is used for auntie, but does that reveal that they have not become integrated into Canadian culture? She uses many Japanese expressions. Much of the way of life is still important to them, but they are third-generation Japanese. And this is the first piece of fiction to come out of Canada dealing with that period. I am told by the bookstore owner that there's one come out from Seattle, University of Washington, called The No-No Boy by John Okada in 1980, which she says sounds similar to this kind of material. I don't know if you know any other examples that go with this, do you? Dealing with that period in both American and Canadian history. I think it's fair to say that Canadians thought themselves quite clean of this issue. And that it is not either been loudly proclaimed in history books or in fiction, and this came as a bit of a shock.
That's available for purchase.
This is for purchase in the library. It's dense poetry.
Bookstore.
This I find so rich in terms of prose poetry, and yet the story is being told. She's going directly through a narrative. But it is the sort of thing you take in small doses. It's not the sort I could read nonstop in one sitting. I'll be interested what you think if you purchase it. Needless to say, it's been translated in Japanese and has gotten wide attention in Japan. So, three recommendations for today in the flesh that we mentioned earlier in the week. Any questions from yesterday? We cut down quite quickly at the end. Or we had to stop quite suddenly, I should say. Any reflections from any of you who were here yesterday?
Oh, we took care of that.
You came.
Oh, you settled it. What was the conclusion, may I ask?
Well, we talked about...
We came up with some new insights about the fact that one problem with relating to her mother was the fact that mom couldn't change because if she changes, then I'm no longer the kid anymore. Mm. And that it was real hard in that respect, you know, that she didn't want to grow up. Those flashbacks of, you know, who's that humming? And you guys, I'm just like my mother.
Yes,
you know,
yes.
I don't want to sound like my mother because if I do, that means I'm getting old.
Yes, yes. And the inevitability of somehow being like mother.
Right.
That's touched on in that story. Go ahead.
No, I finish your thought.
I was going to talk in the story in general.
I was just going to ask, when the daughter has the dream, and she talks about her first true friend, is she talking about her father? There was something.
No, I think she's referring to a cousin.
A cousin.
She identifies with it in the family.
Okay, I didn't know that.
I think she really has something in that story. I think it's rich, and I think it's going to get much wider attention. It's just come out in the last 6 months. So.
I thought the interesting thing about it, too, is you don't know much about the daughter. You don't know what she does.
No, nothing.
You don't know whether she's got, you know, husband, wife, or your husband, children, really where she lives. She has a job, and she's coming.
Remarkable restraint. I've talked in the last 6 or 8 days about the tension between giving and restraint and withholding on the part of the writer, and the balance, the tension, the play that always exists. One of the stories we looked at last week when we were talking about writing endings, how the author twice gave an ending. In the middle of the story, the narrator gives the mother's knowledge of the ending of this event, and then as the story goes on, you get the second version of it. Gertrude's story that we read on Monday, The Death of the Child, has written that story 2 more times. Not rewritten that one story, but taken it from the cousin's point of view. I think I mentioned this yesterday. And taken it from someone else in the relationship's point of view. The giving and withholding. In one story, she wanted to withhold and give it right at the end. In the next story, she tells the beginning what happened and then backs up. There's a marvelous balance of tension that's going on in any writer's work. How much do I tell? How much do I hint? And when do I give what I consider to be that point at which we're moving? And we talked about this not being the ending, it's where the author chooses to finish. The story doesn't end. The story usually lives on by implication, not just in your memory, but the projection you make of what happens next. If any of you want the stories we've read in the last 2 days, I do have copies. We're reading one today, which is Print Dresses, which is less dramatic, I suppose, in action, more unusual in form, and richly textured perhaps as the details that were given yesterday in Homestead Crescent when you had the dump. Do you remember the dump that was burning? Can you still smell it?
Orange
peelings, coffee grounds, and a blue striped mattress. This one has as much in terms of detail, textured detail. I hope you're comfortable listening. One of the reasons I have not passed out stories to be read by others is that I do want to reserve the right to stop and comment. Some of you may not have listened to stories since you're at your mother's knee. If you need to get comfortable, please do so. And if you're not prepared for what's going to happen is that I'm reading Print Dresses and then we're discussing it under the general umbrella of the relationships that are conveyed here in the story. And how many? Yesterday we found more relationships, I think, to look at than I had expected to focus on. Implied relationships, desired relationships, and an actual relationship, which is really up front. One of the things I want you to look for, and I do this as I've done the last 2 days, is the narrator, the nature of the narrator. This is by Mary Riskin. And I told the story one of the days on how the first piece I had published way back when in not a literary magazine said you won't use your name because it's written in first person and you've chosen to write in an unsavory character. And wouldn't this be embarrassing for you? Well, it wouldn't be embarrassing. I wanted all the fame I could get in my career. that they had confused that the narrator chosen by the writer is not the writer.
So the first question we always look at is, even though it's first person, who is the narrator? And how is the narrator's context revealed? What is the situation that's brought her here? And she is in one location. This is one of those stories that takes place in one place. There's no movement in terms of location. And her whole reaction to what's happening. Does she show it? And we talked a lot about showing something, how the father kicks the bag containing the Christmas costumes. The narrator never says he was angry. You see him kicking and kicking and kicking until the bag bursts open and angel wings bent come out. And you know that Papa was angry. In this story, what does she show you? And there is a heap of things she's put together for you as if you were there seeing. What does that reveal about the narrator? She's not going to tell you how she feels directly. And it's that balance between what is shown for you to make your conclusions on and what the narrator feels that the writer will not tell, that play between, again, giving and restraining, how much is shown, how much is told blatantly. And I suggest it's very little told here blatantly. So, print dresses, Mary Riskin. In the dresser of this upstairs room, there is hand-tatted lace that once was precisely tacked to necklines of dark dresses, so that when necessary it could be snipped away and gently squeezed in a solution of pure soap flakes and warm water, then left to dry flat on a towel where the sunlight struck it. The sunlight and the soap have made it yellow. In a lidded cardboard box in the closet, there are balls of brown string, wound as though they'd come that way, and had not instead been collected from parcels and rolled newspapers, and from the grasses and roads where they'd been discarded, and knotted end to end for later use on other packages. The raveling of these brown strings would cross the yard, and the gravel road in front would wind through the ditch of Queen Anne's lace and into the rows of hollyhocks across the way in the garden of my aunts. I can see my aunts through this upper story window pane. They are sitting in two canvas lawn chairs in the shade of their small green shingled house, and they're resting for a moment between the weeding of the vegetable garden and the making of the tea. The lazy nods and dips of their straw bonnets do not suggest the intensity of their conversation. They want me to come out. I've seen them in my garden in the early morning when they supposed I was asleep. I've heard them rattle at my doors and windows. They did not intend, when they handed me the key to this house, that I come in and stay. There is what I would call a slightly surrealistic aspect in this story, and I think I'm going to leave it to you to sort out. There's something slightly one shade beyond a realistic setting. I didn't intend it either. There are things I should be doing for my work, my home, for you. There are things I ought to be doing here as well that I have not yet done. Stacked on an upper closet shelf in this room, which my aunts and my mother outgrew, leaving a storage space, there are dozens of photographs which I have lifted, dusted, and returned. There are photographs of young and handsome men in suits and ties, of women with lace around their necks. There are people who, like my aunts and my mother, knew how to age with grace and self-respect and not a moment of wasted time. There is a photograph of 12 young women in identical robes of white. Some are kneeling, others standing, two sitting on carved chairs. The women are startlingly beautiful. Their hair soft and flowing are caught with hairpins up behind their heads. They are touching one another, each of them with one hand on another woman's shoulder and another at her elbow. This is the picture of a graduation class or the cast of a midsummer play. It's impossible to tell. Just as I cannot be certain in the picture which of the women is my grandmother. My aunts would be able to tell me if I asked them. They probably hoped for that I would carry pieces of this house across the way and sit in the shade with them while they disclosed the past, or that I would call from this upper story window from time to time, bidding them with their mother's house to explain, bidding them into their mother's house to explain what I was holding. They would have argued between themselves, perhaps, or even have called in my mother at some point to settle the matter. They look for excuses to call my mother back, to draw her back to them. That is their way. They grew up as three.
The subjects of the other photographs, with borders stained and browned and crumbling when I lift them too close to their edges, are other people who are connected through blood to me. But there are no names or notes on any of them, not even in a faded ink that I could bring to the light and study. One of my aunts has spied a weed in the flower bed beside the lawn, and now she's kneeling on the grass to pluck it. The other aunt is watching her, or looking beyond her to my front door. What they intended was that I discharge it all within a day or two, taking the things I wanted for our apartment in the city, and packing the rest of it into boxes which they'd left in the woodshed for my convenience. They assumed I'd clean the house from top to bottom in readiness for the agents and movers. I know what they intended and assumed. I've known for weeks that the house was sitting empty, waiting for my sense of duty to mature. They are, my mother and my aunts, too old for such emotional and back-breaking labor as disposing of their mother. Grandmother's bedroom is sparsely furnished and as tidy as she left it. All it required was a little dusting. The thin coverlet, quilted and nearly white, is folded and tucked to conceal the embroidered linen to save the bedclothes from dust and light. It's a single bed, austere and high, but I like it better than my double one, which made it possible for a man to spend the night. You spent the night 10 times, perhaps 11, before you finally moved in. You said it would be less expensive for both of us that way. You've spent more than you saved on gifts for me or the apartment, luxuries that no one has a need for, and the waste makes me cold. On her dresser are the bone-backed brush and mirror which she used so dexterously, one in each hand, 100 strokes through her thin gray hair each night. From her window, which faces away from the house of my aunts, she could see an open field and knew the spit of snakes in the tall weeds, the sticky cling of cobwebs in the trees. She knew them, but left them, too busy with this house for idle wandering. That was for children. The recollections of her own childhood serving up suggestions of blind man's bluff or hide and seek to bore daughters, or later, to her only grandchild. More often, aggravated by such a word as boredom, she'd send them out to pinch suckers from tomato plants or to hang the wash, insisting on a hat to keep away the sun. And silences. She expected that the house would be as silent as it is this afternoon, no matter how many of us were in it. As she took her 1 hour's rest exactly, with a black stocking over her clouded eyes to keep out light. And so it was. I think that you would like to live here for a while. You'd find this old house picturesque, oh, a trifle small, and you would immediately set to work improving it with vertical blinds and bright, bold wallpaper. You'd find a place for a dishwasher, and you'd cover the hardwood floors with acrylic, and the roof with cedar shapes. Your radio alarm clock would go on the little painted bed, the table beside the bed. And the table would have to go eventually, so would the bed. You'd ask me to stop winding the clock on the mantelpiece downstairs because the bombing out of the quarter hours would drive me to distraction. My aunts have gone into their house. Even the exasperation of my being shut in here will not keep them from getting their tea by the appointed hour. And with it they'll have a biscuit and plan their supper of aspic and bean salad and sweet brown bread, baked before noon and left to cool on wire racks on the kitchen table with oil cloth. They will wonder as they set their table with linen napkins and plates and glasses, as their mother always did, what I am eating here. Well, at the beginning, I ate nothing. There were only dead insects where the cornstarch and flour used to be, and I wasn't hungry anyway. But then I found her well-used cookbooks that she'd made herself from empty scrapbooks, and her round script was steadier than I'd ever known it. I remembered Johnny cake with sweet apple jelly, a white sauce thick on soft macaroni, last week's buns steamed back into edibility. Besides some recipes, she glued a black and white of the woman who'd shared it with her, Martha Beardsley, pineapple upside down cake, 1941, wears a black one-piece bathing suit and sits by a gray lake with one hand up to hold her damp hair away from her face. I don't recall her, but I do recall her cake. My grandmother was not the cook that you are, with your pepper steaks and Florentine eggs and fresh kiwi fruit from the market. She didn't waste a cent. I scoop tea leaves from the canister and wait for the kettle to whistle. Here by the kitchen door, I can see out the front window and also out the back. It's a house constructed for people who watch from kitchens.
The clock bongs twice, 4:30. The office will be emptying of everyone but Jack. He'll have to do my work as well as his. And you'll be contemplating a game of racquetball with Harold, followed by an imported beer. The beer will make you amorous, and you'll remember I'm away. You would like to have children, to lavish them with your love and with your gifts, but by the time your golden-headed offspring come, this house will have long been sold, and its proceeds invested somewhere, perhaps for them. There will be nothing of this place to give them but certificates and photographs and talk. In the pantry and then in the root cellar, when at last I thought to look there, I found the sealed jars full of fruit and pickled meats, but flour and sugar in large glass jars with rubber seals so tight that I despaired of opening them, cans of condensed milk, tubs of lard. And I've learned to use yeast again and to soak the raisins in milk before I add them to the batter. I recalled bread pudding. I wish that I had eggs. I clean my clothes in the morning and myself at night, as grandmother always did. I wash the dresses and the underthings on the scrubboard which I found beneath the sink. I leave them to dry on the wooden clothes rack in the bathroom. I wash my hair in the sink, wringing the excess water out before I wrap it in a towel. Already it seems longer, silkier. I iron when it's not too warm. There isn't any urgency to that, for her cotton dresses fit me, and she had several. They're prints. Small and blue or mauve suit me better than the things I brought from the city, and I've stowed all of them away in my suitcase, which is in the front hall closet. I'd like to put it out on the veranda and let the ants decide what to do with it. My grandmother eludes me. I've looked for her as I swept her auburn corners, as I dusted her varnished wood. I've peered at the hand which held the pan and moved the flannel cloth. I've sought the fine grain of her wrist, but I haven't found her. I've stood at the foot of her bed when I rose in the morning and studied the indent in the pillow, but it does not belong to her elegant white head. She isn't here. If she were, I'd take her bird bones against my chest and say that she worked well, but there was a reason for it after all. I see through the drawing room window that my aunts have been duplicitous. Your small green sports car is grinding slowly down their gravel, raising dust which they'll remove from furniture tomorrow. You've brought my mother with you, and in a gesture you'd never dare display with me, you walk around to her door and gently help her out. She greets her sisters with two distant hugs, and then all three of the women glance towards this house. I turn away, the kettle boiling now. I know that they will invite you in for something from their table, at least a cup of tea. They've been curious to meet you. And you, assured, will win them, and they will not notice your surprise that you've been drawn into my family at last. You'll reassure them. She's a woman of her own mind, you'll smile. She'll come out when she's good and ready. They'll offer you cold fruit and biscuits, and you'll ask them for a recipe. They'll listen to your compliments, to your examples of my clear-headedness and control. And all the time you'll be pitying their set ways as you look around the little house. You'll be pitying their narrow-mindedness, their silly print dresses. You'll contemplate entire generations of women who never knew my liberty. My grandmother is not here, but there's more of her here than I can clean away. In this drawing room, pale wood recalls darker wood, of pews and hymnals and grandmother straight back and alert as she attended to the sermon. In this kitchen is her stern look when a child asked for a second helping of dessert or an adult one of sherry. The even seams of her cotton stockings mount the stairs, a neat darn near the ankle, almost invisible. And in this room of hers are the drawers in which she kept her long flannel nightgowns and the spotless cotton undergarments. I am brushing my hair before the mirror, 89, 90. The teal blue print hangs more loosely on me than it did before. She never filled her dresses. When I hear your rapping on the door. While you were drinking their tea, I made certain that the bolts on the door were fast, the sashes on the windows firm.
My grandmother did not take security lightly. You'd need a bulldozer to break in here, and my grandmother's daughters would never allow such desecration. I will come out eventually. For a time, until you've seen what I'm thinking, I will come out to you. But in this house, I remembered why I feel revulsion when you rest your head on my belly and spill your gold extravagantly across the bareness of my skin. I rummage in the top drawer for a hairpin. I know they're here somewhere. And when you finish knocking, I'll go down to pour my tea. Where should we start?
It's a lot more challenging than yesterday's.
Well, we do get progressive.
I really enjoyed all the description in the story. But as she described her grandmother, all I could think of is, what would she have done if her grandmother started to change as the mother did in yesterday's story?
And it would not be this grandmother to remember.
Mm-hmm.
Oh. I disagree on that point. That the, I think you're onto something of what she's evoking in the story. Very interesting contrast.
Constancy.
You knew exactly what to expect your grandmother.
And there's a lot of strength and freedom in that. You know, if you create a structure for yourself and follow it, it's just as strong as the woman who, what'd she say about, he would tell the aunts and mother that she was a woman who knew her own mind. Well, in her own way, Grandma did too, apparently.
His grandmother perceived,
but it sounds like she just discovered that. Or is discovered.
Yeah. And she just discovered that grandmother was a woman of her own mind.
Yeah.
Yule, she's speaking to who? When she says Yule, who's she speaking to?
Her boyfriend.
We can agree he's male, I think. Mm-hmm. You'll contemplate, you will contemplate entire generations of women who never knew my liberty.
Mm-hmm. And that's not true.
You see the grandmother as
very, in her own way, that there was liberty. And she, the place ran according to Grandma's rules. There was an hour nap every afternoon in which there was silence. And you didn't ask, if you were a child, you didn't ask for second helpings of dessert or an adult to share it. You did go to church and sit straight back in the pew. Grandma.
And you would take this, I'm curious about both of your reactions, that this was a kind of liberty. And the word she uses is liberty.
Mm-hmm.
That she had the freedom to create this world, or chose to do so. What is it you were there?
The grandmother.
That the grandmother did, that she can't be dismissed as someone who had no liberty.
Is there a line that says that, or are you
the line,
to
no,
the line
I'm
about
asking,
herself?
The line that the narrator gives, which I think we're referring to, is you'll contemplate, to the man, entire generations of women who never knew my liberty, which would include the grandmother, the three women across the street, and she being the first with liberty.
I don't think that's true.
And you don't think that's true. Now remember the narrator saying, you will contemplate women who never knew my liberty.
Mm-hmm.
So what does that imply? It's his perception.
Mm-hmm.
He will define them. Necessarily mean it's the narrator, it's certainly not your perception.
No, and I think it's not the narrator's perception.
No.
It's my idea of her perception, that she gave that to him. And I hear a lot of, and maybe it was your reflection too, but a lot of anger towards you, whoever he is.
Okay, what other evidence do we have for that? Let's take attitude towards the narrator since it's coming. Do we hear anger towards him?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the line about the bed and saving money and...
You spent the night 10 times. It's, I like it better than my double one, which made it possible. Sorry. And then you spent the night 10 times, perhaps 11, before you finally moved in. You said it would be less expensive for both of us that way.
Not at this place, at her...
At her place.
At her own place.
You've spent more than you saved on gifts for me or the apartment. Luxuries that no one has a need for. and the waste makes me cold. That is a terrible subject.
And the pepper steak.
And the kiwi fruit. Fresh kiwi fruit from the market, pepper steaks, Florentine eggs. She's not the cook you are. She didn't waste a cent.
And what was the line about him putting his head on her lap or something like that?
I have one way of interpreting this, but I may be wrong. For a time, until you've seen what I'm thinking. And I find that an ambiguous line. For a time, I will come out eventually. For a time, I will come... Ah! I will come out eventually. And I think she means for a time I will come out, until you've seen what I am thinking. And it sounds as if she intends to go back in. I haven't read it that way before. I will come out to you. And then she says, but in this house, I've remembered why I feel revulsion when you rest your head on my belly and spill your gold extravagantly across the bareness of my skin. And I take this as some form of birth control that she's referring to, is she not? I mean, I think that's I think it's sexual. And that spill your gold.
It's
related to the saving. What do you do with that?
But she was talking before about having his children with golden hair.
Right.
So I thought it was his hair.
Golden hair.
But it's going to be an intimate kind of sexual
relationship.
And why does she feel revulsion?
Well, that's a question I think we have to answer. I have remembered why I feel revulsion when you rest your head. And then the previous golden head is, but by the time you would like to have children, would like, and that's why I think she's refusing now to have children, and this is one instance of not consummating. You would like to have children to lavish them with your love and with your gifts, but by the time your golden-haired offspring come, and I'd like to say that it's not accidental, the two references to golden hair, and I think you can find ways of dealing with that, which is what we've done. This house will have long been sold and its proceeds invested somewhere, perhaps for them. Your golden-headed offspring doesn't mean it's theirs together, in my opinion.
Except the money's going to be invested, perhaps.
The money's going to be invested for their children.
Perhaps.
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 I mean, it's
her grandmother. Are we sure that they're not married?
No, we have no indication either way. None.
It sounds as though they are not, though.
I believe they are.
She said, you moved in with me to save money. Perhaps that she's staying so long is because she's trying to make a decision for where her life will go. Will she go back with him? Or, you know, does she decide now that she doesn't want him anymore?
I felt they were. He came up with her mother, and then she makes the statement that you have been accepted into the family.
Will be accepted.
Read that.
It talked about duplicity. But it was the aunt's duplicity, not his.
And you assured will win them, and they will not notice your surprise that you've been drawn into my family at last. What can you speculate about that line? He is surprised he's been drawn into the family in this quite unusual situation. What you suppose has been his previous attitude towards being drawn into the family?
She didn't want to.
I would suspect, is implied here. Resistance to being drawn into a family, which to me is marriage, which to me is permanence, which to me is children. Mm-hmm. All of the kinds of things she's talking about, the rooted. Is that reading too much into it? That's the line that I use to suppose that they have not committed themselves to creating anything which we are seeing revealed in the grandmother's life.
Is she attributing, or is the person attributing, the narrator attributing to him the feelings that she also had prior to coming?
There may be evidence for that. What do you think?
I think
that she has quite happily done the artichoke dinners and
and the Florentine and the racquetball and the.
And does it evoke something to you? I mean, she has lethal images here, I think.
Yeah. And it's very authentic, the aged person too, the things that she would find behind. And it's like, now she's here and maybe all the things I thought of that my grandma really aren't really able to come.
She is, I think the story's attributes, one of its best attributes, is this contrast, repeating out details.
this world and that world. Mm-hmm. And that world is what the Florentine state, the Kiwi, and the the third one.
Racquetball.
Imported beer.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Money and certificates.
Money
and
certificates.
Is that something that we're going to look back on as nostalgia?
As, yes. As the rooted, as the kind of thing that's evoked by the grandchildren for us. Yes. Is that what you mean?
Yes.
The grandchildren of this generation, rather than mother, always served at the store.
And
we never stand with it.
Is that the only one in the story that didn't realize at first who she was talking to? It took a while. Was that intentional?
Oh, it took a while.
Yeah.
It took a while before she revealed it. Mm-hmm.
Yes, and I think it's deliberate. That's, I think that's kind of the revelation restraint, but more awkward more reading. I think a story of this nature is definitely the story you read through and then read again, which is somewhat what we're doing, going through it again. The who is you is a question that's posed and very, very restrained.
Did we all catch it at the same time, though?
Where did you catch it?
I guess talking about must have been sharing the bedroom, or after 10 times. You...
Okay, that's only the second reference to you, I think.
The first reference is more general, wasn't it?
The first reference is, and I emphasize that, there are things I should be doing for my work, my home, for you. All right, and that's very open, you don't know. And I think the second reference to you, I think, is the one you spent the night, made it possible for men. I think that's it's a single bed, austere and high, but I like it better than my double one, which made it possible for men. And then you've got the other world she lives in, just beginning to come out like a little string.
I'm wondering, too, that the ants are obviously not married. Her mother's the only one that has been married of the three.
Yes, yes.
And is that another, you know, is she weighing their lives against her mother's life and trying to decide which world she fits in?
She's the only grandchild.
She's the only granddaughter.
This is a very female story.
It's a very female. So this is three generations of women who got here.
Yeah.
And it is the only grandchild. I remember noticing. I can't find the line.
She resisting the ants because she's not sure she wants to be like them?
I don't know.
Oh, but in the same breath, she's wearing her grandmother's dresses.
Mm-hmm.
But her grandmother was married.
But you hear not word one about grandfather.
Yeah.
There's not a single word about grandfather.
Or father, neither one.
Nothing about father. Notice that when the mother comes, she greets her sisters with two distant hugs.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And where has she come from?
The city.
The city, yeah, we assume, I think, because your small green sports car is grinding.
Oh, yeah, the sports car.
You brought my mother with you. And that's another one of the images. You know, if you had to list the 10 images that convey the world. Mm-hmm. Do we know his job? No, not really. Mm-hmm. Jack's doing her job. And he's meeting somebody. At the end of the day, they both work, but we don't know any of that. You know, we so often identify by nature of work, position of work, kind of work, nothing else. Nothing.
Don't you think she's also a little bizarre in the fact that she is taking on your grandmother's role, like wearing her clothes and brushing her hair and not coming out? I mean, most of us, I don't think we would get that deep into our grandmother's life by almost doing what she had done, wearing the clothes that she had.
I think she was testing it out.
Well, I don't know. I just think it's a little bizarre. Surreal, yeah. Realistic. As
okay, let's use that word bizarre for a minute. Hold on.
A little above.
A little while ago. Let's finish with you. The norm.
Yeah, this was back when we were talking about him. I almost had the feeling also, not only was it the austerity versus the lavishness of his life, but that she felt all the way down by him. And maybe that's that three generation of women that, isn't it something about soon he changed the bedstead and then the bed would have to go?
Yes.
And that somehow he had really sort of absorbed her into his lifestyle.
Right. Right.
And she got lost in him.
You'd find his old house picturesque, if a trifle small, and would immediately set to work improving it with vertical blinds, can't you see? In the color, no doubt. And bright, bold wallpaper. You'd find a place for the dishwashers.
You'd cover hardwood floors with acrylic, the roof with cedar shakes, the sauna out back, the jacuzzi on the right. Your radio alarm clock would go on the little painted table beside the bed. And the bed table would have to go eventually. So would the bed.
So would the bed.
That would reinforce the contrast with the nostalgic recollection of the grandmother was in charge.
You know that commercial where the...
As opposed to him taking over the church, the commercial?
Yeah.
The commercial on TV where the woman's redecorating the house and she changes everything and the man is sitting in the middle of the room.
And there's nothing left.
And she says, well, you don't go either.
Yeah.
She moves him up. And you know, maybe she's feeling that same kind of thing. Do I go, you know, am I losing myself?
I think that when it's only that paragraph as well, Sandy, I think that fear that she has somehow gotten lost. I think, you know, what if there were no man? The encounter with the death of the grandmother and the things of the past is always, I think, demands answering who am I in relation to this world. Mm-hmm. That's a concentrated dose of a world, isn't it? I mean, fancy her visit to grandmother as a child. You're there to play and what have you. Here you are here to deal with a life. And we get it really concentrated. You cannot escape asking my life in relation to this life.
In reference to that, one time she says flat out, my grandmother has eluded me. And then not too many paragraphs later, she says, my grandmother is not here. As if all this putting on and acting out still doesn't get her in touch with what she's looking for.
Doesn't she say something in the end, though, that she is here more than... Isn't there something at the very end that she affirmed that there was more substance at the end? I can't remember the exact words, but...
Let me just look.
A couple paragraphs.
We talked about yesterday that nothing is by accident, and I wondered if
things... I think you can trust this story to have nothing by accident. I'm going to go back to my grandmother has eluded me, and elude, not allude, my grandmother eludes me. Now, you've mentioned the word bizarre, and I use the word realistic, which I'm not sure is exactly the right word for here, but there's a level at which this is, and I feel comfortable with this, I don't know if you feel comfortable, that she is really there. Do we have to ask if it's realistic that she's actually been there living off the food in the pantry?
She's losing weight.
She didn't eat in the beginning, but now she's opening up all these jars and she found she's losing them. She didn't go out to shop. She didn't bring any
eggs. I wish I had eggs. As if she were powerless to go. I mean, that's what's a little bizarre.
She's a dentist. She's not going to leave. Yeah. She doesn't want anybody in.
But she's sort of she doesn't want under a spell.
What time
almost like a purging.
How
did she spend there?
You had to guess.
I say a few days.
She'd make a good movie. When I at last thought to look there in the pantry, I found sealed fruit and condensed milk. So she can do this baking in terms of the art. She makes it perfectly believable that this is, in fact, possible. There's a feeling I get, and I can't put it in words, that there's part of memory, there's part of what we say wish going on here, there's part of actuality. But I think the author deals with it as if it were actually happening. You could be there projecting yourself into living like this, could you not?
There is a whole dimension of fantasy in being her grandmother.
Yeah.
It's hard to tell how much is...
How much is, this is the way I can imagine myself, and this is the way I have been the last week, right? The fantasy of, I'm looking for my mother. Grandmother is here, sorry. Mm-hmm. I will find her.
Maybe she hadn't seen her grandmother for a long, long time. Maybe her memories only go back to childhood.
And this is why this business of
to know her now, or before she died, she had to almost become her and wear the clothes, lose weight. She said the dress is loose on her. Her grandmother never forgot the dresses either. I mean, but she can't make the same impression on the bed that her grandmother did. So she knows she's not her grandmother, but she's trying to identify with herself.
And I had the sense all of a sudden that she was becoming her grandmother, and her wish in the fantasy was to be grandmother. I want to return and be grandmother and be welcoming. And I've got a model, and it's a model that works, and I want to welcome the children home and suggest they go play. What was it? The games that grandmother knew all about.
It's the tomato lines.
suckers on the tomato, couldn't stand boredom, and she had two games, blind man's luck or hide and seek, and I would be my grandmother for a moment. I can't. Back there's one, then Marie, and then here.
I just had a question. Why did she inherit the house and not her mother?
That's what I was going to ask.
She doesn't understand why her mother wasn't.
Yeah. If somebody in our culture, it's the.
I didn't know she didn't realize she inherited.
You know, she has,
I think it's her job. I don't know
she
if she's inherited.
I was going to ask you, what's your evidence for that she's inherited?
Yeah.
She's there too. Oh, because he was going to get the money.
Yeah.
They are. Well, eventually she will.
Eventually she might. She's the only granddaughter.
They are, my mother and my aunts, too old for such emotional and backbreaking.
Oh, she did have to put her mother in there.
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
Her mother was gone.
In the beginning, I thought her mother
was disposing, as disposing of their mother. Disposing. That word is as disposing of their mother. What do you suppose that they have asked her to do? They assumed I'd clean the house from top to bottom in readiness for agents and movers.
Mm-hmm. So, the things that she wants.
The sense of the house was sitting empty, they've left the boxes.
There was a wonderful phrase, they were waiting for her sense of duty to the children.
I've known for weeks that the house was empty, waiting for my sense of duty. The house was waiting. I think it's a house.
The house is waiting
for my sense of duty to mature. They've taken the things I wanted for our apartment in the city. Small. I mean, how much can you take from damage an apartment? And packing the rest of it into boxes, which they've left in the woods shed for my convenience, and it doesn't say what will happen with that. So it's not just you encountering the past, you're encountering the future without the concrete remnants of the past.
Okay.
How many of you have been there in that place, somewhere near that place, disposing your encounter in the past in dramatic concrete detail, and the expectation that it is going to be snapped?
There was a real nice... I just think it's a wonderful atmosphere of nostalgia that's created here. Old houses, empty, disposing of houses, ants, and dresses, and, you know, but, and I really like the touch at the beginning that's related to, now you have a ball of yarn. But there was a time when my aunts even marked out,
this is how far away.
And this is how far away.
Across the yard, the gravel road in front, and wind through the ditch of Queen Anne's lace and into the rows of hollyhocks across the way in the garden of my aunt's. And there's a wonderful poem which I don't have, it's very short, it's almost a haiku, about the string of your ancestors you must never cut the connections to. But it has to do with the ball of string.
But also the notion of a woman being in charge related to marking out the boundaries and lines and so forth.
I think she realizes she doesn't have much time to spend in this home, in this situation, and she's trying to make it last as long as possible.
In readiness for the agents and movers.
So it's predestined.
They expected her probably to get in and get out, and she wasn't going to be in a hurry if she wanted to stay as long as she could.
I have this play, again, between fantasy, you know, that I see fantasy and reality. In reality, she's going to stay there and keep that house and sever herself with him and by whatever means make this place, keep this place. And the other part is the fantasy. I am the grandmother from the past, and I will be here permanently, and I'm going to start keeping house, you know. And I think they move between each other very...
And the last part sort of comes in when she wants to be the grandmother. I mean...
Or she is the grandmother. That, I got this sort of shiver when she says, on her dresser, one hand brushed her hair. It's still beyond that. My grandmother eludes me. I've looked for her. Mm-hmm. I stood at the foot of the bed when I rose in the morning. I almost thought she was going to say, I'm seeing a silver hair on the pillow. Do you any of you know Rose for Emily Faulkner's story? Well, it's a bone-chilling story, but there's a bit of the atmosphere in there. Emily is a white woman in a town that's told by a black Mary. I think I've got this right. There was a mysterious death of one of her hired hands way back when. There's a stink in the house they're all complaining of in the present. Well, she's kept the body in her bed. It was the body. And when they go to clean up the house at Emily's death, Rose for Emily, there is the strand of hair of the man who disappeared mysteriously. And it's chilling. It's beautifully done. It's the same notion on the indented pillow. I think is exactly the image I expected to see here. Was the strand of hair with the grandmother is somehow still there. It does not, I studied the indent in the pillow, but it does not belong to her, in it, her elegant white head. I am not my grandmother. I am different, but I want, you know, is it I want to be the same, or I'm inevitably the same, or I feel myself carried from an older, as suggested. She isn't here. And then if she were, what would she say to grandmother? I'd take her brood bones against my chest. Chest. Emily said, whispered to me in chapel the other night, why do old people always get shorter? And if you could hug your grandmother against chest down here, the smallest suggestion. And say, do you remember what she's going to say? And I think it's a very significant line. Because it has to do with what she wants. I think the woman narrator wants assurances of. And say that she worked well, that there was a reason for it after all.
I was puzzled. A reason for it after all.
What's this?
You know, is it grandma's life? Or the order she imposed on that life? Or all
this,
of that?
What has grandmother done? She's kept house.
Yeah.
He scoffs at that, though.
Okay, and I think the contemporary narrator, you couldn't spend your life doing this, could you? Lace, winding string, or canning fruit, tubs of lard, could you? This woman is asking, is she not?
Mm-hmm.
What value do we assign to that? What possibility is there for doing that?
But I think when she slipped into that house and into that role, she questioned. Then that was, you know, much more real.
Question what?
I mean, she was questioning how she could have made that blanket assumption before.
That it wasn't that.
Yes.
Is there sentiment in this story?
No. Oh.
I don't mean feeling. I mean sentimentality, which is exaggerated sentiment, or asking you to feel more than is appropriate for the circumstances, all right? Sentimentality we usually associate with Hallmark called cards. In other words, given the situation of death, the words just do not, you know, they, well, I'm talking about sympathy cards done by Hallmark cards. Sentimentality, not feeling, but synthetic feeling generated by playing on you, manipulating you somewhere. Any sense of that here? Because
the story seems to be about as austere as this.
Yes, there's a great
austere
character. I think you quite remember. Very restrained. It's a situation that you can be sentimental about, can you not? This outpouring of, oh, in the old days it was so much better.
Mm-hmm.
More than that, is it not? There's nostalgia here, but it is also a very, I think, an analytical question going on about what, you know, what is a value.
It's the old lifestyle.
Yeah.
I wonder why the ants have never made contact with her. I mean, why do they sit and wait for her?
She wouldn't.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. She
didn't sound
like Well, she's checked. She says, for a time, while you were drinking your tea, I made certain that the bolts were fast. Mm-hmm. She's already bolted them, but she's checking everything twice.
Mm-hmm.
The sashes on the windows are sashes. One of those old-fashioned words. My grandmother did not take security lightly. You need a bulldozer to break in here. And I had this feeling that that's exactly what he might try.
Right.
The bulldozer, this says, who said he might take over? I think it was you, Sam. Bulldozing over.
Mm-hmm.
The overwhelming sense. He might bulldoze in here. And my grandmother's daughters would never allow such desecration.